Good morning, church. Man, everybody should be so enthusiastic. That's fantastic. Oh, it's good to see you. It's good to be here. As Russ said earlier, it's always good to be gathered together with family and friends, with loved ones, with the body of Christ here at Forest Mill. And Sunday is a special time for us. It is. We gather on Wednesday evenings, and we have, you know, service projects that are going on, and retreats for the teens, and other times we gather together. But Sunday morning is a special time. Do you remember the old blue laws? Remember the old blue laws? Raise your hand if you remember those. You know what I'm talking about? When stores wouldn't be opened on Sundays. You remember that? I remember that too. I remember when I was a kid. Am I doing this? Is it me? Okay. No, it's Marcus. All right. I'm just kidding. Oh, they do a great job, like 75% of the time. And I shouldn't say that about people who can shut off my mic at any moment. Anyway, I remember as a kid, the blue laws, and you go out, and a lot of the stores would be closed. And even those that were open would have like certain sections marked off, to where you couldn't go and buy just anything. They might have things that were covered over with a sheet or with cloth or with paper, with, you know, chains across certain aisles, where you could buy some things, but you couldn't buy other things. Sundays were special when I was a kid. They really were, and they were kind of viewed as an equivalent, I mean, roughly, as the Old Testament Jewish Sabbath day. I mean, that's the way that culturally we tried to treat it. It was supposed to be a day of rest and worship. And a lot of homes, a lot of Christian homes, it was observed with the same sort of ritualistic rigidity that Jews observed the Sabbath, and that the Pharisees were really looking for in their observances. And then today, really, we got this pendulum. It swung all the way back in the other direction, where not only in our society, but even in many of our Christian homes, there's almost, you know, no importance placed on a day that's set apart for rest from normal activity. We just don't place a great deal of emphasis on that any longer. In Jesus' day, the Sabbath was one of two defining features of Palestinian Judaism. The rabbis had developed this entire set of rules around the principle of the fourth commandment. The fourth commandment, for those of you who remember, is remember the Sabbath and keep it holy, right? That was the commandment. And God said, you shouldn't work, you shouldn't make your servants work, you shouldn't even make your animals work. Everybody needs a rest. Everybody needs a rest. And so the rabbis, the teachers of the law, they took that and was like, what does it mean? What can we do? What can we not do? And they're trying to get specific. I mean, perfectly normal way of treating that law, right? It'd be like if I left my house and I told my kids, you know, don't watch too much TV. And they're like, well, what is too much TV? And what TV can we watch? And they might come up with a whole host of rules. And with my kids, it would be like not more than 12 hours in a day, you know. But we try our best to interpret what God said and keep that. Well, that's what the rabbis did. It wasn't a bad thing for them to do that. But they developed all this system of rules about what you could do and shouldn't do on the Sabbath. I remember some of those distinctions in our laws, in our blue laws. You know, you could get gas on Sunday. I remember you could go to the cafeteria for Sunday lunch. Like, we had a Luby's, which, of course, we were big city folk, and we could go to Luby's to get Sunday lunch. That was like a big deal. But you couldn't go to the hardware store, right? And you couldn't go to the liquor store. Not that we tried, but those were closed too. And there were a lot of stores that were just, you couldn't do anything like that, right? In Jesus' day, you could eat your meals, you could gather together and set out your meals and eat. But you couldn't prepare your meals. Like, you couldn't cook your food or prepare your food. You had to do all that the day before. If you were sick, you could get medical treatment, but only if your life was in danger. If it wasn't in danger, if your life's not threatened, then you just put it off till tomorrow. It's not a big deal, right? If you've got a cold, it's one thing. You don't have to go and get treatment for that, which they certainly wouldn't have. But if your life was in danger with an illness or an injury, you could get treatment for that. And again, to be a good Jew meant that you were keeping all of those rules straight. That's what it meant. And it was an era, and it was particularly important to them because Roman and Greek culture was just sort of permeating everything. It was spreading over everywhere. The Greco-Roman culture, and remember, they were ruling in Palestine, and a lot of Palestinian Jews were sort of, they start working first in Greek cities, and then you start sort of adopting their practices, and they certainly worked on the seventh day of the week, and then so your employers are expecting you to be there, and you've got to keep your job, right? So they started doing that, and just more and more to where you're just sort of basically like everybody else in Greco-Roman culture. So to be a good Jew, you had to really practice those things. These were our distinctives. This is what it means to be a Jewish person. So keeping the Sabbath was that important. It was cultural identity in a very un-Christian or ungodly culture. Right? This is what marks us as being God's people in a culture that's not God's people. Now, already in Mark, we've seen how Jesus has been pushing the Sabbath envelope a little bit. You may recall earlier in the book of Mark, he cast a demon out of a man on the Sabbath day. That man, this demon-possessed man, came into the synagogue at Capernaum, and he interrupted them, and he sort of confronted Jesus, and Jesus cast the demon out. Now, that was on a Sabbath day, and it technically wasn't a life-threatening illness, but he was disrupting the synagogue, so chances are, everybody sort of said, okay, that one was okay. You can do that on a Sabbath day. If they're interrupting synagogue services, casting out a demon sort of makes sense. And then later, he healed Peter's mother-in-law, which Peter talked about this morning. He healed not this Peter's mother-in-law. He killed the Apostle Peter's mother-in-law on the Sabbath day. But that was, it was in a private home, and it could have been a life-threatening illness. We're not told from the Scriptures. It certainly implied that it was a very serious illness, but it doesn't specify life-threatening or not. But since it was in a private home, you could kind of maybe get away with that. Maybe word didn't spread as fast, and it was tough to prove it because the people who were there aren't going to want to verify some of the details if they know it could get Jesus in trouble. But it appears that maybe these things have contributed. They put Jesus on the Pharisees' radar. Because remember, the Pharisees, they were about keeping those rules. They were about being distinctive. They were praying for the return of the Messiah so that God would deliver them from the bondage to the Romans. They were all about that. They weren't the zealots. They weren't ready to fight or anything like that. They were just praying for God's deliverance. And they were very religious, very spiritual people. And so it appears that these two stories might have put Jesus on their radar. Certainly the previous three stories have demonstrated that Jesus has crossed into their comfort zone, like crossed the boundaries that they're comfortable with. He forgave a man of his sins. He's eaten with sinners and tax collectors. He's doing all these things to sort of press their buttons, that's pressing their buttons. He's not doing it just to press their buttons, but it's doing that. It's having that effect. And now Mark strings together the last of these controversy stories. There's five in a row. And the last two are really strongly linked because they both have to do with the Sabbath. And they illustrate how Jesus has authority and power even over the Sabbath, the tenet of Judaism. How Jesus is Lord even of that. Now, the first story comes at the end of Mark chapter 2 when Jesus and his followers, they're cutting through a field. And it's evidently late summer because the harvest hasn't come yet. But it's near enough that the disciples are able to pick some heads of grain. And it may have been a type of corn. It could have been a type of what we would think of as regular grain. We don't know exactly what it was. But they were able to pick some grains and eat it as they're going through this guy's field. Now, that's perfectly permissible by law. You can go back to the Old Testament. It was a tenet that God put in there to protect poor people. If you're poor and you're hungry, you shouldn't starve to death. So you can just walk through somebody's field and you can get grain and eat it with your hands. That's fine. That wasn't the real issue. The real issue was that they did this on the Sabbath day. They didn't break it by cutting down. Now, if you took a sickle to another guy's standing wheat or corn, that was big trouble. But you could pick it with your hands. Nobody had a problem with that. The problem was that they did this on the Sabbath day. And Jesus, when they confront Jesus about this, you know, why are you guys doing this on the Sabbath day? Jesus reminds them of the time that King David was on the run from King Saul. He wasn't really king yet. He wasn't acting king yet. David was on the run from Saul. And they were starving to death. I mean, Saul had just about run them to death. And so they show up at the tabernacle at Nob. And they beg the priest, do you have anything to eat or drink? And the priest's like, I got nothing. I got nothing except for the bread of the presence. Now, the bread of the presence was symbolic of the presence of God in the tabernacle. It was holy bread. It was set apart bread, consecrated to God. And the priests could eat that after someone brought along new loaves. Someone came and made more bread of the presence. They'd bring it, and you could take the old bread of the presence, and you could eat that. It was permissible for the priest. Black and white in the law, priests could eat the old bread of the presence. Nobody else. Nobody else. But David and his men show up. They're starving to death. And like, do you have anything? The priest said, I don't have anything except for the bread of the presence. And so David and his men ate that. Now, they weren't priests. David and his men were not priests. But they ate the bread anyway. And so Jesus reminded them of that incident. And even though David wasn't a priest, it was okay because they were really hungry. Technically, they broke the law. Technically, David and his men broke the law because they weren't priests. But as Jesus points out, the spirit wasn't broken. The purpose of the law wasn't broken because human need supersedes ritual observance. Now, this is kind of going to be our guiding principle for the morning. Human need supersedes, it's more important than ritual observance. Doing the right thing is more important than doing the lawful thing. Does that make sense? That's the principle that Jesus is establishing here. That human, taking care of humans. Now remember, Jesus, he's the Lord of humanity. He is come to save humanity. As the Lord of humanity, that makes him Lord of the Sabbath. And this is what he says. I'm over the rules, and I'm telling you that taking care of people is more important than taking care of rules. These rituals, these laws that God gave you, they are about more than just following the rules. It's about taking care of us. All of the laws, every one of the laws in the Old Testament, you go back and you read and you're like, this is super detailed. And some of them have to do with the way you worship and the sacrifices you make. Some of them have to do with how you keep your house, where you keep things in your house, how to treat people who are sick. There's laws that regard everything. And every single one of those laws, all of them in the Old Testament, they are all for the good of us. They are not for God. Those laws are not for God. But God doesn't need us because God is completely self-sufficient. God doesn't need you. He doesn't need your money. He doesn't need you to be here on Sunday morning. God doesn't need you to be faithful to your spouse, to pay your taxes and not beat your kids. God doesn't need that stuff. But you do, and I do. Right? They are for our benefit. They make us into what we were meant to be. God doesn't need our prayers. God doesn't need our money in the plate. You think God couldn't accomplish what he wants to accomplish without my check or cash? God doesn't need those things. We need those things. And so Jesus wraps up this story about the Sabbath with really it's a proverb. And this is what he says. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Now you and I see this Son of Man here. I have it in yellow. Son of Man right there, right? And we see that. We know that's a title that Jesus calls himself. He calls himself Son of Man, and it's really kind of a coded way of referring to himself as the Messiah. He is the Son, the ultimate human being. And we recognize it rightly as a messianic title, as a way of calling himself the Messiah. But literally, it's a Hebrew idiom. Literally means son of a man. Means a human being. Right? If you're a son of a God, that's one thing. If you're a son of a human being, that's something else. So when Jesus says the Sabbath was made for human beings, not human beings for the Sabbath, so human beings are Lord of the Sabbath. It kind of says that. He sort of slips it in there, and you and I see it's a sneaky way of talking about himself, but to people who are listening, they're just kind of puzzling through that. This is going to be years until Jesus dies and is resurrected and ascends into heaven, and the word of the gospel spreads, and then people are going to believe Jesus is the Messiah, and they're going to go, oh yeah, I remember that time. Jesus says the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. He's the Son of Man. I get it now. But all of this story sort of leads up, it's leading up to a big high point here. It culminates in this final incident. We've got the principle, we've got the guiding scripture here now. And here, finally, Jesus is going to openly challenge his opponents. And it's going to set into motion events that are going to ultimately lead to his death on the cross. This is where the road to the cross takes a steep turn, if that makes sense to you. He's been heading there since his birth, and it's true. It's always been his destiny, and certainly once he began his ministry, you can point to it. But this is where Mark's gospel starts sharply pointing us toward the cross. And this is what he says beginning in Mark chapter 3. Another time, Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Now, some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus. Doesn't say who some of them were. We're going to find out later it's the Pharisees. So they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. They're looking. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, stand up in front of everyone. Literally, arise in the middle. Arise in the middle. Then Jesus said to them, what is lawful on the Sabbath? To do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill. But they remained silent because it's an unanswerable question. We'll talk about that in just a moment. He looked around at them in anger and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, their hard hearts. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. He stretched it out and the hand was completely restored. The Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. Now, there's some things about this that make it a really unique story in Mark, chief of which is this is the only time in the whole Gospel of Mark that Jesus heals someone and they didn't even ask for it. Nobody approached him. Nobody asked for it. He just walks up to a guy who's standing there and asks if he can heal him, right? Because this story is not about the healing. This is not a miracle story. Sometimes the stories are about the miracle to prove Jesus has the power. Mark's already done that. He's already proved to us Jesus has the power. This isn't about the healing at all. It's about the challenge being presented to Jesus here. And clearly Jesus knows this is a challenge because there's a lot of ways he could have handled this differently. He could have handled it more privately. He could have called the guy outside. Let's go around back. I'll heal you back here. Nobody has to see. Nobody has to know. It's okay. Don't go and don't tell anybody, right? He could have done it that way. He could have waited a few hours until the Pharisees or the scribes dissipated. And they go to their homes. He's like, all right, guy, come over here. Now let's get you all straightened out. He could have taken the guy to a private home the way he went and healed Peter's mother. We'll do it in here. Not as many people will know. It'll be fine. There's all these ways he could have done it privately. Instead, Jesus looks at him and says, you arise in the middle. Get in the middle of everyone. Which in the synagogue would have been, I mean, that's not a great big room. It'd be tiny by our standards. And he gets him into the middle of everyone. And remember who he's challenging is the religious leaders. Who has the best seats in the synagogue? The religious leaders. They have front row 50-yard line tickets, permanently reserved. So he has this guy standing right in front of them. Now this story is dripping with irony. Just think about it. The Pharisees know Jesus can heal. And they don't even think about where that power has come from. I mean, no, Jesus, this is not like he's a really good doctor. This is not like he's a fantastic magician. I can't figure out how he's doing it. No, they know Jesus can heal, as in making paralyzed people walk heal. They know Jesus can look at this guy's withered hand. And the phrase there for the withered hand, it could be that he was paralyzed. It could be he was born with some sort of birth deformity where he was unable to move it. It could have been any number of things, but the hand was essentially unusable. And Jesus says, stand in front of them, watch this, and restores the man's hand completely. Because this, again, the story is not about the healing. We already know Jesus can heal. This is about doing it right in front of the Pharisees. And he asks them a couple of questions. And we'll talk about the irony here. He asks them a couple of questions. They know Jesus can heal. So Jesus says, which is lawful, to do good or to do evil? To save a life or to take a life? Now remember, earlier we heard this principle that the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. The Sabbath was made for us, for human beings. We weren't made for it. Now, if that's true, then what's the right thing to do by this guy? Right? If the Sabbath was made for him, for the man with the withered hand, if that was made to benefit him, then what's the right thing to do by him? If that is God's true and overriding concern, then it's for us, it's for human beings, then what should be done for this man with the deformed or mangled or paralyzed hand? Does God want us to do good or to do evil, to save or to kill? Now that sounds to save or to kill. I thought, well, Jesus is going too far there because nobody is saying kill this guy. Right? The Pharisees aren't saying kill the man with the withered hand. They're just saying, don't heal him right now. But Jesus isn't saying that leaving the guy unhealed would be the same as killing him. No, this wasn't a life-threatening injury. If it were, it would have been perfectly legal to heal this guy then and there. Instead, Jesus is comparing what the Pharisees are doing to what he is doing. Jesus is finding ways to help people on the Sabbath. They are finding ways to kill people on the holy day. And they don't even see the irony in that. Jesus is helping people who are hurting on God's holy day. And they are finding ways to kill God's holy one on God's holy day. The Pharisees were so hard-hearted that it made them blind to their own hypocrisy. They can easily see what everyone else is doing wrong and cannot see what's wrong with them. Remember, take the beam out of your own eye before you try to remove the speck from your neighbor's eye? Got to look inward first. So blind that they go off to plot, not just with anyone, they go off to plot with Herodians. And in a lot of ways, you could not find a more antithetical group to the Pharisees. They were almost polar opposites in Jewish society. You get the Pharisees, strict religious group, praying for the return of the Messiah, praying for deliverance for the Romans. And then over here you've got the Herodians. The Herodians were a political party, and they were all about supporting the Roman government, and they were really secular. They didn't follow the laws or anything like that. The Herodians just wanted to keep the Romans in power because that's how they stayed in power. Herodians as in Herod, as in the Herod who tried to kill baby Jesus, now his sons who are ruling in different districts there in Palestine. Those Herods, they weren't really kings, they're not really descendants of David, but what they were rich, they were powerful, and the Romans kept them there because they could sort of, it was just sort of a way to keep people under their thumb. And the Pharisees, the people who were all about religious observance, plot with, it would be like the religious leaders today getting together with the mob bosses. That makes sense? Because the mob bosses, they don't care anything about ethics or morals or following God's law. They didn't have anything in common except for one thing. They both feared Jesus. The Herodians, they're afraid that Jesus, he's powerful. He is clearly very powerful, and he's getting a large following very quickly. And if this gets too upset, the Romans are going to come down, and they're going to squash everything. And they may decide they don't like the way we've been running things. We've got to get rid of this guy. He's a threat to our political power. The Pharisees, on the other hand, Jesus is a challenge to their religious authority. We've been the experts for so long. We've told everybody how they ought to do it. And now Jesus is saying, you don't have to do it like we say we got to do it. And we want to make sure we're keeping God's law. And Jesus threatens that. So Jesus was a threat to their religious authority. He's a threat to both ends of the spectrum. And so they unite. The enemy of my enemy is my friend, right? The exact opposite groups unite against Jesus. And it is so easy, to be fair, it is so easy to become concerned with keeping the rules, especially important rules like God's rules. It's so easy for us to become infatuated with that and become consumed with that we miss the intended purposes of those rules. But God is not satisfied with rule keeping. He's never been satisfied with rule keeping. That has never been his goal. Even in the Old Testament, where he keeps calling people back to his law, the purpose was not the law itself. God, again, remember, God doesn't need anything from us. He doesn't need us to keep the laws. And he said, like in Hosea chapter 6, verse 6, God says, I desire mercy, not sacrifice. And even though you've got laws and laws and laws about sacrifice, God says, what I really want is mercy and acknowledgement of God rather than burnt offerings. What I'm really looking for out of this is for you to be in right relationship with me, right relationship with your fellow man, and right relationship with creation. That's what I want. That's what the laws are about. That's what the rules are about, is for you to come to right relationship with everything and everyone. That's always been God's aim. The prophet Jeremiah, he too looked forward to a day when God had this new covenant with his people. When he says, I will put my laws in their minds and write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they will be my people. In other words, Jeremiah said, God is going to have a new covenant. A new time is coming when there's going to be no more need for written rules. No more written rules. Think about that. None. Because the law is not written, and as important and as loved and as valued as this. This is not what's important. It's the God that's in here that's important. The rules in this holy book are not what's important. It's the God we meet through their observance that's important. That's what he's saying. That there's going to be no more need. When this new covenant comes, no more need for written rules. Because as believers, we're going to be spiritually attuned to God's desires and purposes. That's what makes the rules important. That's what makes the laws important. That's what makes the Bible important, is that through them we get to meet God. And as people of God, sometimes, especially those of us in churches of Christ, I know I'm getting stepping on toes now, but we've been really, really concerned with getting things right so much that we fail to see the damage that we're doing to ourselves and our fellow man in an effort to make sure we get things right. And I am not saying that about an accusation against anybody out there. It is an accusation of myself, because I would quietly take delight in the dig that others threw at me. Y'all think you're the only ones go to heaven. And I'd be like, I am. I liked knowing that I was right and others were wrong. It gave me a great measure of self-righteous pride. But what if I was wrong? What if we were wrong? What if God's aim all along was for us to be the dispensers of healing and life rather than condemnation and death? What if we were truly the bringers of good news and hope to the lost, not condemnation to the lost? What if God's purpose in leading us and creating us and making us a people, what if God's purpose through that was to save us from the recklessness of our rules application and bring us into right relationship so that the rules are no longer the most important thing? What if that was God's aim all along? What if God is calling you this morning not to do things right, because Lord knows you and I have done a lot of wrong things. But what if he's calling you this morning not to do things right, but to get right with him and then let the right things flow out of that? You know, if my wife and I were on the outs and and I were a vindictive kind of person, I might say, here's what you're doing wrong. List 1 through 25. And she'd give me my list of what I'm doing wrong. List 1 through 250. And we could both be right. And I say, okay, now here's what you need to do to fix this. List 1 through 25. And she could give me my list of what I need to do right. List 1 through 5,000. And all those things. I've got all those things, and they're true, and they're right. And I give them to my wife, and she's like, okay, I'm supposed to do number one. And she starts going down the list, and I start going down my list, and we can do everything right and still have a broken, fractured, separate marriage. Because rule-keeping does not make relationship. But when my wife loves me like she does, and I love my wife like I do, sometimes you end up keeping those sorts of rules because you love each other. Sometimes you remember to do those things you may not even like to do because you know they like it. Because you love them. And that's what God is seeking. That's what Sabbath rest is about. That's what Sunday morning worship is about. That's what a day of rest and a day of worship ought to look like, coming into relationship with God. And if this morning, if you've been living out of relationship with God and you know all those rules you've been breaking and you're concerned about it, feel guilty about it, you're self-conscious about it, and you know, I just need to start doing these things right again. I need to stop doing this and start doing that. Well, you may be true, but let's focus on the most important thing, the thing that God has been aiming at all along, which is getting into right relationship with you and Him. Let's focus on that this morning and let the rule-keeping flow out of that. And if we can pray for you, encourage you, prayers of forgiveness, prayers of strength, or if you're ready to become a child of a God who's more concerned with who you are than what you've done, that's the God who's seeking you this morning. If we can do anything for you this morning, won't you come now as we stand and as we sing?